Listener supported. WNYC Studios.
To all the little girls who are watching this, never doubt that you are valuable and powerful and deserving of every chance and opportunity in the world to pursue and achieve your own dreams.
I've spent my entire life in business looking at the untapped potential in projects and in people all over the world. That is now what I want to do for our country. Tremendous potential. I've gotten to know our country so well. Tremendous potential. It's going to be a beautiful thing. Every single American will have the opportunity to realize his or her fullest potential. The forgotten men and women of our country will be forgotten no longer.
So here we are. We named this series The United States of Anxiety because it seemed to capture the fact that this election was more about emotional realities than about policies or ideologies. There's a group of white Americans who feel powerfully wronged, and there's a burgeoning majority of people of color and women and young people who are terrified about how that white grievance will manifest itself. And now Donald Trump has been elected president, and he's been elected with an historic turnout of white voters, not just working class white voters, but white voters of all classes. He won white people by 10%. So in the final episode of this podcast, we want to go back to the beginning of this political moment, this era from which Trump's campaign emerged.
But race is an issue that I believe this nation cannot afford to ignore right now.
This is candidate Barack Obama back in March 2008. Responding to outrage over his pastor, Reverend Jeremiah Wright. It's widely understood to be one of his best speeches, perhaps one of the most notable speeches in the history of American politics.
The fact is that the comments that have been made and the issues that have surfaced over the last few weeks reflect the complexities of race in this country that we've never really worked through. A part of our union that we have not yet made perfect. And if we walk away now, if we simply retreat into our respective corners, we will never be able to come together and solve.
He goes on to talk about black anger, about generations upon generations of injustice that just can't be wiped away with a few civil rights laws, about the frustration that lingering bias generates. But then he pivots to white people. And given the election we've just been through, what he says feels to me prescient. I'm stuck on it, and I'm going to just let it play for a couple of minutes here.
In fact, a similar anger exists within segments of the white community. Most working and middle-class white Americans don't feel that they've been particularly privileged by their race. Their experience is the immigrant experience. As far as they're concerned, no one handed them anything. They've built it from scratch. They've worked hard all their lives, many times only to see their jobs shipped overseas or their pensions dumped after a lifetime of labor. They are anxious about their futures, and they feel their dreams slipping away. And in an era of stagnant wages and global competition, opportunity comes to be seen as a zero-sum game in which your dreams come at my expense. So when they are told to bus their children to a school across town, when they hear an African-American is getting an advantage in landing a good job or a spot in a good college because of an injustice that they themselves never committed, when they're told that their fears about crime in urban neighborhoods are somehow prejudiced, resentment builds over time. Like the anger within the black community, these resentments aren't always expressed in polite company, but they have helped shape the political landscape for at least a generation.
So like I said, here we are. This episode, we're going to check back in with a lot of the folks we've spoken to earlier in the series. And first and foremost, WNYC's Arun Vanugopal got back in touch with Patty Dwyer, our Trump supporter in Long Island. Hey, Arun.
Hey, Kai.
So, Patty, side one. How's she feeling?
Well, as you can imagine, she's feeling pretty good.
I'm feeling wonderful. I'm feeling relieved. I feel a heaviness that I've felt for like the last couple years is really lifted, and I'm feeling great today.
Now, this has been kind of an emotional process for Patty, not just the election, but serving as the main subject for this series and speaking on behalf of Trump supporters. Our relationship was kind of a roller coaster, okay? There were times when she stopped responding to my texts. On a couple occasions, she even broke up with me. She said she wanted nothing more to do with us. "Sorry, it just can't do it, Arun," she texted. She didn't feel like anyone was actually listening to her. And now that the election is over, it's kind of like night and day, okay? Although Donald Trump hasn't even entered office, she feels this sense of possibility. She didn't feel it even a day before. It's almost as if the country has changed overnight, as if it's a place where she feels valued, where she suddenly feels at home.
Overall, it's a wonderful, wonderful system. We're so blessed to live in this country.
But I was curious, what did she make of all the people who are terrified of living in Trump's America? We played her an exchange that my colleague Beth Fertig had with the young black woman, a teenager, on the subway, about what a Trump administration means to people like her.
He's gonna bring back slavery and stuff. Yeah. And, like, you know, me being, like, black.
Do you feel like he could bring back slavery?
Yes.
He's taking the country back 50 years.
And he's really racist.
This kid, Allison, she said, he's gonna bring back slavery and stuff, me being, like, black. How do you reassure somebody like that, who's this young person who feels really scared?
That young lady, I would suggest her older sister, who might be mature and working and, you know, or whatever, would turn to her and say, "Honey, you need to start to think a little positive. You need to step back. Maybe why don't we investigate why the media has presented Donald Trump as a racist? Let's investigate it ourselves. Let's not trust the media alone. Let's listen to what the media says and then investigate ourselves, and then we'll see. And then maybe you don't have to walk around so stressed and paranoid, and you know what I mean, and have a nice light life. You're a young lady and you have same opportunity as anybody else in this country." That's how I'd handle that.
Patty's response is exactly what I'm worried about.
This is a friend of mine, Nanihal Singh. He's Sikh, and he lives in Montgomery, Alabama. And he's been carefully listening to this series, as well as to Patty.
That, in fact, she won't be willing to see things from the other side. And that worries me, because particularly people like Patty say, "Hey, we're not being heard," but they're not willing to listen either.
On the night of the election, Nanihal thought he'd go and watch the returns at a bar. But then he and a friend decided that he really shouldn't, because he wears a turban. And he told me he thought he was actually at risk if he were to step outside. We spoke the day after the election. He was trying to make sense of the results.
"I'm sorry, I'm just flustered. I don't know what to do with the Patties of the world. I don't know. It's been a very hard 24 hours, and I'm not being coherent. But I'm alarmed, and I'm not trying to be alarmist. It's the anniversary of Kristallnacht, and obviously we don't have that here. But I do think there are a lot of ways in which things can get a good deal worse. And I was naive about that before 9/11. But after 9/11 and after seeing all the videos of Black Lives Matter, I've had to dramatically change my understanding of the importance of race in American society. And the unwillingness of some of my fellow citizens to see Americans of color as full and equal citizens." I'm sure Patty is very kind, but I worry a little bit about the Patties of the world, because she didn't see what I saw in Donald Trump at all. And she supported him without being concerned about the way he treated women, blacks, Latinos, Jews, Muslims. None of this bothered her. None of this was something which she considered was a red flag, nor the fact that, you know, he insists on saying the Central Park Five should have been executed even though they were exonerated by DNA evidence. None of this matters to her. And that's very hard for me to put up with or just understand. I mean, I'm from New York, so I know Trump. I'm not personally, but Trump's someone who didn't pay his bills, who shafted everybody. Just even if you want to talk about 1950s honor systems, he's a dishonorable man. He really is. And yet, for somebody to like Trump that much, to think that he's going to be some sort of panacea, that he's a hero or a savior, the only way in which I can make sense of that is that it must be because he's white. Because if there was a black man who had all of those characteristics, I don't think it would have been tolerable for a second, not for 1 second.
Nunhall imagined a scenario in which he got to sit down across from Patty and just talk to her.
And what I'd ask her to do is to listen to people whose experience of this administration is going to be very different and look at the evidence really fairly. But here's the second question, and this is the harder one. She sees herself as a principled person, someone who stands up for what's right. And I want to ask her if she's going to be willing to stand up for our rights and for the Constitution. Because Trump shows that he's not willing to respect the Constitution at all.
Nunhall has a PhD, and he wrote a really important book on military coups. He and I are both Americans of Indian descent. We've been to the same weddings. We have a lot of the same friends. Clearly, though, we are living in fundamentally different Americas. There's the one that I live in, Queens, where women in burqas pass by drag queens on the sidewalk. And then there's another one, the one that is suspicious of people who look or dress different, no matter how accomplished they are. The one that banned South Asians for decades from this country after arguing that we were dirty, that we brought disease to America. I thought that this America was on its way out, but I'm now reminded that it is not.
What do I think is going to happen? At the very least, I expect to see a ton more Confederate flags around. I expect to see a spike in Klan activity. These are actual real risks. This isn't hypothetical. And I don't know what happens. I love going on road trips in the South. And I was looking forward to doing some more. And now I know that I'm going to have to be a lot more cautious about going places.
All right, so we just heard from Nunhall in Montgomery, Alabama, and how concerned and frightened he is. We're now going to turn to the nation's Julianne Hing, who's been covering immigrant communities throughout the podcast. And Julianne, we reach you in the airport in Phoenix, Arizona, where you've been for Election Day. You've been down there in Arizona. How you doing?
I'm okay. It's been, as I'm guessing it's been for the rest of the country, it's been exhausting. It's been a very wild ride for people, especially here in Arizona. You know, I came out here because there was a lot of potential. There was a lot of excitement on the ground.
And to clarify, there was excitement on the ground that Latinos and people of color were going to flex their political muscle in Arizona.
Correct. I mean, the thing is, it wasn't just Donald Trump on the ballot. Sheriff Joe Arpaio, the notorious hardline immigration sheriff who's been in office for 23 years, was up for re-election, and he lost. And so on one hand, for immigrant communities, Tuesday marked a real big triumph. And on the other hand, it was a devastating blow because of the national news. I went to a press conference yesterday. It was ostensibly to celebrate, you know, the ouster of Sheriff Joe Arpaio, but the mood was somber. The mood was mournful. People were crying. I happened to meet a young woman who was one of the lead organizers of the Basta Arpaio campaign. Basta, meaning enough in Spanish. Her name was Abril Gallardo, and she's 26 years old, and she's undocumented and a recipient of DACA, which is one of President Obama's initiatives, which allows young undocumented immigrants to have a short-term protection from deportation. It also gives young undocumented immigrants the right to work and the right to drive. And she's had this status now for 4 years, and she had been working. She'd gone to school. She said that this December she's just about to finish her associate's degree at a community college and transfer to Arizona State University. But because this program is completely at the discretion of whoever, of whatever presidential administration is at the helm, and because Donald Trump has vowed to do away with this program, her future is completely in flux right now. She said that she had been working and saving for the last 4 years, and she had finally put away enough money that she wanted to start looking for a home to buy for her parents. But all of that is up in the air, and all of that is a big question mark hanging over her. She told me that the fear now that her family could be separated is actually bigger than the fears about what could happen to her personally. And so now she said she's just focusing on trying to keep her family together and keep them feeling safe when right now she feels anything but safe.
Right. Arizona is, you know, notably a place that they've been through controversy with the infamous bill SB 1070 that was also about a draconian enforcement program there. They've been through Sheriff Arpaio. So, you know, are people afraid of this coming mass deportation? Are people preparing for it? How are people responding to that impending reality for these 700,000 families at minimum?
You know, I met another woman. She's also a young activist. Her name is Stephanie Aguilar, and she's 22 years old. And she told me, we've lived with this. We've lived with Sheriff Joe Arpaio she's 22, and Sheriff Joe Arpaio had been in office for 23 years. She's never known a world without this man running her county. And the kinds of policies and the kinds of practices that Arpaio pursued as sheriff are very much in line with what Donald Trump has proposed. And so she said, we know what this is like. And she told me that in 2010, she and her mom actually had made a plan to always stay close to home. If they could avoid going out of the house, they would. But now, 6 years later, she told me that she doesn't want to tell other people to stay home or make their lives smaller. And she's urging other people to be brave and to say, we're here, we're not going anywhere, and we're going to stay and fight.
Another place that's been in this kind of fight for a long time is Patchogue, Long Island, where we've spent some significant time already in this podcast. That's where Marcelo Lucero was murdered by seven teenagers in an anti-immigrant hate crime back in 2008. The community has been working for 8 years to overcome that moment. It's been hard, certainly, but there's been some success. WNYC's Stephen Nesson visited Patchogue just before Election Day, and he found troubling signs that some of that progress is already coming undone. Hey, Stephen, so tell us what you found in Patchogue.
I talked to Principal Tim Pacciullo, and he pointed to a rally Trump held in Patchogue in April. Think of it. Patchogue is a small village. It's 2.2 square miles with about 12,500 people. This rally was a big deal, and Pacciullo says it affected the kids.
We had students at the time leaving on the rally day saying, build a wall, just because they're hearing either parents or news or things going on. And that's kind of not the culture that we tried to breed here in school.
Is that scary for you to hear?
It wasn't necessarily scary, but it was eye-opening at the time to say, what more can we do to educate students about accepting everyone?
He says he can see that Trump's aggressive language toward immigrants has noticeably made students and parents nervous.
All along this school year, we've had some fear here and there with our Latino students as far as, am I going to be deported?
Students say that to you?
They say that a lot to our social workers and our school psychologists.
What I heard from many people is that Donald Trump really has set this town back. Let me give you an example.
Could I get you to say your name for me? I didn't catch your full name.
Lizbeth Carrillo.
And how old are you?
I'm 29, just turned 29.
Liz has an 8-year-old daughter, Layla. She goes to a local Catholic school, and she says many of the parents there are huge, vocal Donald Trump supporters. There's one parent she actually argues politics with, whose daughter gives Layla a hard time.
Her daughter told Layla that, why is she so dark if everybody's pink? And since then, Layla has this thing about being, she is a little bit darker than me, but I tell her, you have a beautiful skin. Until this day, she doesn't like her skin. And she's in a school with all white people, and they noticed. And when they noticed, she noticed the difference. She never noticed that before.
Next up, we hear from two of our tour guides who helped us understand Trumpland, and from American journalist, activist, and feminist Gloria Steinem.
What if millions of Black Americans had been compensated for slavery? Join me, Trymaine Lee, as I explore the untold story of one of the only Black Americans who ever was. I talk to his descendants and discuss how reparations forever changed their family's trajectory and imagine a reality where reparations are paid to the rest of Black America. Into America presents Uncounted Millions, The Power of Reparations, a Black History Month series. New episodes drop Thursdays. Listen now, wherever you get your podcasts.
This is a vote against the future, and the future is going to happen anyway.
Gloria Steinem dropped by the WNYC studios after the election to talk to the program The Takeaway.
And it does feel like a vote against the social justice movements that have made so much change and actually changed the majority opinion, and against the insecurity of borders these days and change in general.
She spoke about the way this election will have implications for women and therefore the larger culture of the U.S.
The way that we begin hierarchies is controlling reproduction, and that means controlling the bodies of women. And of course, if there is a strong racist system or a caste system as in India, then it becomes even more vital to control reproduction because that's the only way you can maintain the separation of groups that racism or a caste system or a class system requires. So those things are intertwined and they're fundamental, but they are still viewed as a kind of side issue. When you look at the predictors of whether a country will be violent within itself or whether it will be willing to use military violence against another country, the strongest predictor is not poverty or access to natural resources or religion or even degree of democracy. It's violence against females. It normalizes the idea that one group is born to dictate to another.
Steinem feels despite the very real setback this vote represents, the racial balance in the population of America is going to change.
The first generation of babies who are majority babies of color have already been born, regardless of their ability to stop immigration or slow immigration or to do away with family planning and so on. I mean, you know, this people look you in the eye and say the white race is committing suicide through contraception and abortion. I mean, they really believe that. But the fact is that they can slow change and they can make it much more painful, but it's inexorable. I mean, we are going to change. Consciousness is changing. The idea of possibilities are changing. We, you know, from understanding that marriage and love and connection happens between two women and two men, I would say in general what we are figuring out and what incidentally I think we knew for most of human history before colonialism and a whole bunch of other stuff is that human beings are linked, we are not ranked. That the paradigm of society is a circle, not a pyramid.
Finally, Gloria Steinem was asked if Donald Trump is her president.
No. No, he's not. You know, I'm not going to disobey the law, but I'm not going to pretend he represents me.
So I've called up a couple of people we heard from earlier in the series, a couple smart guys. Chris Arnotti, who is a writer for The Atlantic magazine and The Guardian newspaper and a photographer, and we talked to him back in episode 5. And WNYC's Matt Katz, who we talked to about media in episode 4. Chris and Matt, welcome back.
Thank you for having me.
Thanks, Kai.
So here's our question. You know, we're trying to understand this really unprecedented surge and wildly unexpected surge in white voters that happened over Election Day. And Chris, let me start with you, because when we last heard from you, you talked about the sort of what some of the emotional drivers for Trump's white supporters. Were you surprised by the outcome?
I was surprised by the outcome, but I wasn't surprised. I mean, I saw all the dominoes set in place, and I didn't think they would just all topple. The way I would say it before the election was, when someone asked me if Trump's going to win, I'd say, I don't know about this election, but at some point in the next decade, a Trump will win. It's just a little bit earlier than I thought.
So what were those dominoes? Tick off those dominoes for us again.
You know, it's just two very different Americas. You know, I used to be a banker. I'm not a banker anymore. I spend my time driving around the United States, talking to people in communities that most people don't visit. And they're just two entirely different worlds. And it's a world that doesn't understand each other and doesn't talk to each other and doesn't get along with each other. And it goes both ways. And the world that I inhabited before, the banker world, the world that most of us, you know, who live in New York know about, that world controls things. And viewed from the other world, it's considered rigged and rotten.
That world being the global elite.
Yeah, the global elite, you know, I call them the front row kids. They're people who have postgraduate degrees and they went to the right schools. We sort by education now, and it's people who have the right education.
Mm-hmm. But then I have to say, you know, when we're looking at the returns here, I mean, yes, the non-college educated white voters were enormous turnout, but it wasn't just them. Trump won big amongst white voters that we weren't expecting. He won white voters overall by 10%. He won amongst white women. He won a surprising number of college-educated whites. I wonder about the role of race here versus just...
Oh, there's certainly, I mean, the first pass is racial, right? I mean, we sort ourselves by race. Everything we do in this country is sorted by race, and that's no different how we do our politics. But I would also say that when you look at the Trump voters, when you think about, when I say it's communities left behind, it's not just the poor people in the community, it's not the white communities, it's not just the people who are struggling, it's the whole community. The whole community feels like it's changed. You know, Danville, Virginia, Prestonburg, Kentucky, Parma, Ohio, these places that are defined very geographically and very locally, and the whole community feels very much like it's been left behind. And that's very much where the racial angle aims. Part of that community is primarily being exclusively white.
And so in that sense, the whiteness, the racial part is almost coincidental. Matt, do you agree with that? Were you surprised by the outcome, particularly amongst whites?
I was certainly surprised. I don't know what motivates many of these folks, but white women, 2 weeks after we found out that Trump joked and boasted about assaulting women, white women, most of them voted for Donald Trump over Hillary Clinton. I don't know how gender and race factored into their hearts there, but it's certainly confounding. Being left behind economically is certainly not the only reason that went into people's decisions. I went to a community in North Philadelphia on Election Day. It was one of the most impoverished and distressed physically looking places I've been to in quite a while, and I've spent plenty of time in inner cities around the country. This is a precinct in North Philadelphia that has not cast a single vote for a Republican presidential candidate since at least 2004. I can't understand how economic anxiety could be the driving factor here. And what I'm left with is race, particularly given the rhetoric of the campaign.
Chris, when we spoke to you in episode 5, you talked about humiliation. And I wonder if, you know, regardless of your actual literal economic situation, if your feeling of humiliation for whatever reason can nonetheless be a driver.
There's this concept that we have a meritocracy, that all you have to do is get educated. So when you don't make it, it is now your fault because you haven't succeeded educationally. And I think that humiliation plays out in both poor black neighborhoods and poor white neighborhoods, and it plays out differently. It plays out in poor black neighborhoods, as many sociologists have talked about, as the culture of respect, you know, the code of the streets. And it's playing out in poor white neighborhoods through identity politics, you know, fascism light, if you will.
It's an interesting point. One, there's a couple things there. One, I can absolutely understand how if you would feel humiliated, that would be a terribly strong motivator to get you to the polls. But then one of the things that we've all struggled with in our politics, we are very accustomed to the idea that you have to have an operation, some sort of get out the vote operation to capitalize on the way people feel in order to get them to the polls. And Matt, I wonder if in the mixture of that humiliation and the identity that Chris is talking about, what role did right-wing media play as some sort of new version of get-out-the-vote organizing?
The get-out-the-vote operation was Facebook. It was social media. Breitbart, this website that was really just absolutely in the bag for Donald Trump, where the alt-right lives and thrives, where anti-Semitic and racist ideology is peppered in casually with like pictures of gorillas and articles about whether Obama was born in Kenya, where anti-Trump Jews like Bill Kristol are called renegade Jews. That site figured out how to capitalize on Facebook. The Trump digital team with Steve Bannon, the former head of Breitbart, who went over to be the CEO of Trump's campaign, used some of those same methodologies that Breitbart had used to become a dominant media organization. Plenty of other sites on Facebook capitalized off this as well. There was a couple in the Philippines that was pulling off all kinds of stuff about Trump off the internet, true and not true, and posting it on Facebook. Their Facebook page got more views than the nightly news does, or even Fox News does on a normal day. The game totally changed in this cycle, and Breitbart is at the heart of it and will continue to be at the heart of the next administration, because Trump will continue to surround himself with those people. And Breitbart, which is taking a massive victory lap in the wake of the results, is going to drive the message of the Trump administration. It's hard to know where it goes from here, because Breitbart sits right next to avowed white nationalists. They have ties to avowed white nationalists. They flirt with avowed white nationalists. And it is a slippery slope that we're now on toward that end.
So, Chris, when you hear that, is that hyperbolic? When we're saying Trump's campaign staffers, and presumably going to be his White House staffers, sit next to avowed white nationalists and white supremacists in the media landscape, speaking to these group of people who feel humiliated and left behind, how do you feel when you hear that?
I would say this country is divided, economically and culturally divided. There's a huge gap between the two divisions, and it's becoming two different realities. Fascist politics or racial identity politics is predictable from that. You put that situation where you have these two groups who live in different worlds, with one seen as being doing better. It's almost like you created a perfect platform for racial identity politics to just step right in and provide the people who feel like they're on the outside a sense of renewed pride. Where I would only push back slightly is Trump got a lot less votes than Romney did. And Clinton got a lot less votes than Obama did. And if you look at some of the places that Trump won, places like rural Pennsylvania and Iowa, they had priorly voted for Clinton, for Obama. So this place that is now slipping into this narrative, it's white identity politics, voted for a black president 4 years ago. So what's changed? You know, it's not like racist just sprung up, or is it?
Well, what has changed? I mean, it's a real question, because a number of the people that we've interviewed in Long Island, that is true as well. And we were told throughout this podcast, as we brought this up to pollsters, we were told, well, that's an aberration. That's not the pattern. And it's turned out to very much be the pattern.
There are two things that struck me over the last year and a half talking to people in Trump country. A, the number of people who were voting for Trump who had voted for Obama, and B, the number of people who missed Bernie, who would have voted for Bernie. I think one of the things that will come out over the next month is this idea that Trump didn't so much win as Clinton lost. First of all, Trump didn't win the popular vote. So, you know, this idea that we're being taken over by this swarm of extraordinary angry people needs to be tempered on both my end and others.
Well, that said, he won the presidency through the way that we win the presidency, which was the Electoral College. So they,
yeah, but you know, when you look at the, identifying why, a lot of it's the way the two groups are set in the country. You know, one of them happens to live in a place that is convenient for getting more electoral votes. In that sense, it might lower some of the ramifications of what happened. Going back to what was discussed about the media, for the last 10 years, when I drive around the country, I listen to right-wing talk radio. So Trump's language and his comfort with outright racism and sexism is not surprising to me. It comes right off of conservative talk radio. It's been there for the last 6-7 years.
And so that's what changed between the Obama voter who becomes a Trump supporter is their connection with this media.
I don't think they have that impact. It's more complicated than that.
It's more complicated than that for sure, but I will also say that this did not come from nowhere. For about 10 years, bubbling up from the far right has been an avowed fear of other, and that other are Muslims. Bills to ban Sharia law have now been introduced in all but 16 states. That means state legislators, local newspapers have been talking about this Sharia law creeping into the United States, which is a absolutely bogus phenomenon for a decade now. 6 years ago, Newt Gingrich, who, if you read some reports, could be our next Secretary of State, said Sharia law is a, quote, mortal threat to the survival of freedom in the United States and the world as we know it. Out of this rhetoric came groups that capitalized off of this fear, that made money off of this stuff, that went on conservative talk radio and hawked books, that they had conferences. They went to Tea Party groups to do speeches. They went to conservative churches and even Jewish groups. And what they would do is talk about this encroaching Islam. And they would go to communities that often had an influx of immigrants, like St. Cloud, Minnesota, where there's a lot of Somali Muslims, and people were concerned about the change nature of their community. And these opportunists on the right would connect people's concern about the changing nature of their own communities with this larger Sharia law that was coming in to turn all their daughters into hijab-wearing Muslims. And then all of this was echoed on sites like Breitbart. It's all sort of come together, and it's been sanctioned and legitimized by what we would call, I guess, normal traditional Republicans like Newt Gingrich for a decade now. You know, conservative media is one piece of that, but it's not alone. It's also Republicans, traditional Republicans are also responsible. And, you know, conservative groups, these groups that make money off spreading this fear are also responsible.
So let me ask you this, Matt, in terms of moving forward, if the conservative media, this microphone that connected these feelings of humiliation to this aggrieved white identity that Trump is capitalizing upon, if they're been so crucial to this, they are now so deeply tied to the Trump White House.
Yeah.
In terms of an administration that has its own media platform, essentially, and can circumvent everything we know about an administration having to do with deal with traditional media, that's kind of scary. Well, scary or promising, depending on your political perspective. But it seems to me that the Trump administration is set up in a way that might be unprecedented in terms of a political voice to its constituency.
It's set up in a way that'll be different in how they communicate to the American people, for sure. What has kept me from sleeping over the last 24 hours is less how they communicate and more how they act. Does Attorney General Chris Christie or Attorney General Rudy Giuliani, if there's a bombing at a mosque, do these attorney generals, whomever they may be in the Trump administration, do they expend the proper resources to go and figure out who did that? If it ends up being a white nationalist group, do they prosecute it as a hate crime? Do they come out strongly from in front of the microphone against such acts, or do they wink and nod to racists like the campaign and their surrogates did over and over again over the last year and a half? So I've really been wondering how the hate that all of these Republicans have allowed over the last year and a half, what that then turns into in an actual presidential administration. The legitimization of this racist right, it was so startling to me in the 24 hours after the election. I got a press release from an avowed racist named Jared Taylor, and the press release looks like any press release you would get from a legitimate politician or pundit who wants to get on your show. It says, spokesman, Trump's victory is a victory for the alt-right. And then it goes on to say how the alt-right helped to elect Trump. And Jared Taylor, president of the alt-right organization American Renaissance, is available for interviews on what the election means for the alt-right and for white identity politics. And then they go on to say how Trump must halt non-white immigration, deport immigrants, et cetera, et cetera. Like the guys from the Cato Institute or something. He's from a neo-Nazi group. It's unbelievable.
So this is
what is the Trump presidency could be leading us to.
So this is a very dark picture that Matt paints. Chris, I want to give you the last word on this. I gather that you will say that it's a not automatic step from the humiliation that is behind these communities that feel like they have been left behind to allegiance to the people that Matt is talking about. If that's the case, what stops that from happening?
Matt's picture, I think, is aggressive, but I don't think it's out of the question. And so what I worry about is I think Trump is going to be an incompetent president. I think he's going to face a lot of problems. He over-delivered promises. And when he starts failing, what do you think he's going to do next? He has an easy solution on how to basically try to save his presidency. And that's going to go down the path that Matt was talking about, which is to blame.
How do you interrupt that? What is the thing that in your travels and meeting these folks who feel so aggrieved and so humiliated and that are vulnerable to that, but presumably aren't just avowed, you know, I don't hear you saying that they themselves are neo-Nazis. What is the thing that is going to interrupt this dark vision that we are hearing here?
If a liberal looks at a poor black community and says, oh, there's statistically a lot more violence there, they say, well, let's put some context behind that. Why? Well, there's a lot of reasons. Structural racism, no access to jobs, degraded institutions. When people look at a white community that has an uptick in racism, has an uptick in racial politics, I think you have to ask the same question. Why? Why? Why is it now? Why are we a country that some of these counties that voted for a black president are now voting for, as Matt correctly says, an avowed racist? Why? What's changed? And I think what's changed in my mind is I think there's this sense of feeling further falling behind. They're fighting against a rigged system. And when Trump can't fix that, and he's not going to be able to fix that, then they're going to go down the path that I think Matt laid out. And that's very scary. And how do you stop that? I don't know how you stop that. I mean, in some perverse way, you hope Trump does well. I mean, you know, everybody, you should want his presidency to be successful.
Hey, he's the president of the United States at this point. We need him to do well. Absolutely.
Yes, exactly. You want his presidency not to be a disaster. I mean, we always should want that in our president, but in his case, even more so.
And just as black anger often proved counterproductive, so have these white resentments distracted attention from the real culprits of the middle class squeeze, a corporate culture rife with inside dealing, questionable accounting practices, and short-term greed. A Washington dominated by lobbyists and special interests. Economic policies that favor the few over the many. And yet to wish away the resentments of white Americans, to label them as misguided or even racist, without recognizing they are grounded in legitimate concerns, this too widens the racial divide and blocks the path to understanding. This is where we are right now. It's a racial stalemate we've been stuck in for years. And contrary to the claims of some of my critics, black and white, I have never been so naive as to believe that we can get beyond our racial divisions in a single election cycle or with a single candidate, particularly a candidacy as imperfect as my own. But I have asserted a firm conviction. A conviction rooted in my faith in God and my faith in the American people, that working together, we can move beyond some of our old racial wounds, and that in fact, we have no choice. We have no choice if we are to continue on the path of a more perfect union.
That was Barack Obama 8 years ago. But when he gave that speech, the conservative media that produced Donald Trump was only just beginning its campaign against all things Obama. Somewhere over the following 8 years, millions of white people decided that the president's message of national unity didn't include them. They rejected his idea that we're all in it together against greed and selfishness, and they came to believe it was them against the globalists. and all of us who seem to fit that bill. And so the consensus of 2008 is definitively gone. For many people who call America home, the consequences are stark. A lot of us are scared of the future. Even Trump supporters have told us over and over again that they fear the future too. So that's the work before us, moving from fear back to hope. I don't know how we get there. I really don't. But I know what it looks like.
It requires all Americans to realize that your dreams do not have to come at the expense of my dreams. That investing in the health, welfare, and education of black and brown and white children will ultimately help all of America prosper. In the end, then, what is called for is nothing more and nothing less than what all the world's great religions demand. That we do unto others as we would have them do unto us. Let us be our brother's keeper, Scripture tells us. Let us be our sister's keeper. Let us find that common stake we all have in one another. And let our politics reflect that spirit as well.
The United States of Anxiety has been a production of WNYC Studios and The Nation magazine. Reporting this week by Arun Venugopal, Julianne Hing, Matt Katz, and Stephen Nessen, and produced by myself, Joseph Capriglione. It's recorded and mixed by Bill Moss and Casey Means. Our theme music is by Nathan Halpern. Thanks to our digital team, Lee Hill, Alex Kahn, and Jennifer Hsu, and The Nation's digital team, Frank Reynolds and Annie Shields. A big thanks to our friends at WNYC's On the Media, Only Human, and The Takeaway, and a special thank you to WNYC's Jim Schachter. Karen Frillman is our editor and executive producer, along with Kai Wright.